I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. As the United States and China trade threats over Beijing's increasing assertive posture in the South China Sea, the tension is already affecting the livelihoods of many in the area. The Spratly Islands are claimed by several nations, including China, the Philippines, Vietnam, and fishermen in the Philippines say they are being prevented by Chinese patrol ships from fishing near the islands. Su Lanin visited China and the Philippines and prepared this report.
8-year-old Su Chengfun is from the fishing village of Tongmen on Hainan Island in southern China. He says he's been fishing in the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea since he was 14, until his retirement at the age of 69. 51-year-old Liu Yuyong is still fishing around the Spratly Islands, which are claimed by nations including China, Vietnam and the Philippines. Mr. Liu says the disputed islands belong to China, and his ancestors have been fishing there for generations. He spoke through an interpreter.
We know about the conflicting claims. However, we know this is our own waters because our ancestors have been handing down these waters generation and generation. They told us this is our own water, so we believe this is our ancestors' water.
The Hainan fishermen get government subsidies of around $30,000 per year per boat. Mr. Su and Mr. Liu showed us their maps and the compass they use to get to the islands. Through an interpreter, they explained it takes 3 days to sail to the Spratlys, which are called Nansha in China.
The fishermen here have been fishing in the South China Sea for many, many generations, and they had no problem of fishing there, and they did not encounter many foreign fishermen for such a long time until very recently.
While the Chinese fishermen may sometimes sound like they are echoing the Chinese government's line, in the Philippines, the provincial governor of Zambales, which borders the South China Sea, put on a forum for visiting international journalists.
To give us the updates on Scarborough issue, without further ado, may I call on our governor of Zambales, Hermogenes Titani Jr.
Governor Hermogenes Ebdane has set up a surveillance system to monitor foreign ships in Philippine waters. At the meeting, the assembled fishermen complained they'd been chased away from the Scarborough Shoal in the Spratlys, which was seized by China in 2012 after a standoff with the Philippines Coast Guard. 43-year-old Filipino fisherman Vianney Muller says a Chinese Coast Guard ship used water cannons against him and other fishermen last year. He spoke through an interpreter.
Natatakot po.
He said that he felt scared when they were blasting water, and he felt bad because he wanted to fish in that area. He's just a small boat that was against a Chinese Coast Guard ship.
Mazenloc Mayor Desiree Adora says the local fishermen have seen their incomes plunge because they can no longer fish in the Spratly Islands. She says the local council has put in place programs to help retrain the fishermen for other jobs.
There's a great impact on their lives because as the fisher folk says there, he is earning around 300,000 a month. And now, he's earning around 300 pesos a day.
It's been a big hit to the livelihood of 56-year-old fisherman Macario Ferones. He hasn't been back to the Scarborough Shoal since being threatened with guns by the Chinese Coast Guard 2 years ago.
The Chinese Coast Guard say, go away, and they have gun, AK-47.
How did you feel?
Scared. Very scared.
What did you do?
Go home.
Mr. Ferones had to sell one of his boats and the other is grounded. He now works as a fish vendor at the market and doesn't receive any government assistance. He spoke through an interpreter.
When he's fishing at Scarborough Shore, actually he earns more money. And he earns for as much as 300,000 pesos monthly. But now, he is actually earning for about 300 to 500 pesos daily as a vendor, market vendor.
To China now, where a passenger ship carrying more than 450 passengers has sunk in the Yangtze River, triggering a rescue effort that is being hampered by strong winds and heavy rain. Eleanor Hull speaks next to China correspondent Stephen McDonald.
Well, the first thing I should tell you is something has just popped up as a report from the People's Daily saying that there are possibly passengers still alive inside the capsized ship. Now, that's coming from the People's Daily, is like the official organ of the Chinese Communist Party, and this is a report coming from one of its blogs, so not necessarily from the actual paper, but if they're saying it, it's possibly from quite a strong source. But as to why more people have not been rescued, it's a mystery, because we don't even know what's caused this. I mean, the ship went down overnight, and it's obviously sunk pretty quickly because, as you mentioned, there's 450 people on board and they've only rescued around a dozen. And how could that be? How could a ship carrying hundreds of people go down so quickly? There are reports from the captain who did survive that the weather was extremely bad. You know, we've talked, there's heavy rains, there's heavy wind, but still why that would cause the ship to sink remains unclear.
So you've been to the region before, Stephen. How treacherous is it?
Well, the crucial thing is that this is a very busy river. I mean, it's wide, it's huge, the Yangtze. It's China's mightiest river. It's the most important river in the country. But it's also a very heavy waterway. And so imagine there are large ships containing coal or cars or all sorts of freight, as well as lots and lots of passenger ferries. This is people who are going all the way from like Shanghai up to the Three Gorges Dam. So you can imagine if the weather was bad, if visibility was poor, well, it's possible you could strike another ship or something like that. And certainly the currents are also very strong. That's why the Three Gorges Dam was built there, to generate so much electricity. So if you were to fall into the very murky waters of the Yangtze, it would also possibly be very difficult to get out of them, even if you're able to survive the sinking.
Stephen, are there any suggestions that it could be anything more than an accident?
Not at this moment. It does seem that there was no sort of foul play, but the rescue is going on as we speak. And if it is true that there are people still trapped inside this ship somewhere underwater in very murky waters, which would be really difficult to get to. I mean, it's like being inside of a surging chocolate milkshake of a river. You can imagine how difficult it would be to try and get to those people.
This week, Australia's defence minister had a three-day visit to Japan at a heightened time between tensions over the Chinese expansion in the region. While Kevin Andrews held talks in Tokyo, an Australian warship was sailing around the secured hotspot in the South China Sea, paying visits to friendly nations. As defence minister and national security reporter Andrew Green reports, Australia and its allies are deeply disturbed by China's spying construction on reefs and atolls in the region.
China's rapid territorial expansion in the South China Sea has rattled the United States, Australia and its allies, and the activities being closely monitored in Canberra. Defence Department Secretary Dennis Richardson.
The land reclamation activity by China in the South China Sea has been at a pace and scale over the last 2 years beyond anything we have previously seen.
Appearing before a Senate estimates hearing late yesterday, Acting Defence Chief Ray Griggs confirmed an Australian warship, an Anzac-class frigate, is currently in the hotly disputed region.
HMAS Perth is currently operating in that region with visits to Thailand and Cambodia, so by default operates in the, operate in the western part.
Today, Defence Minister Kevin Andrews will get a first-hand feel for the regional tensions with his first official visit to Japan. There, he'll meet his Japanese counterpart. During the three-day tour, Minister Andrews will also visit the Kawasaki Mitsubishi Heavy Industries Commercial Shipyard in Kobe, which is competing to build Australia's next generation of submarines. The government's so-called competitive evaluation process has also attracted the attention of Senate estimates, with Labor's Stephen Conroy questioning the Defence Department's submarines manager, David Gould.
The outcome that we're looking for, Senator, is to find the right long-term partner for the design, development and production of Australia's future submarine. I believe this process is well designed to do that.
I think you are very successfully providing the government with the outcome that it needs to put the fix in.
I object to that.
Government frontbencher Simon Birmingham demanded the Shadow Defence Minister apologise to the senior bureaucrat.
I don't think I made any inference on Mr Gould's character at all.
You did.
I made an inference on the government's character.
You did? You said I'm providing the government with the outcome that they want. In one sense, that's true. The outcome they want is to find the right long-term partner for Australia. I doubt if that's what you meant.
A Cook Islands counselling centre says it hopes to empower victims of domestic violence by giving them access to free legal advice. The Pangawatarua Group has launched a pilot program which focuses on mediation services and early intervention for female domestic abuse violence victims. Leilani Momorse reports.
In 2013, a major health survey on violence against women revealed that 32% of women in the Cook Islands have experienced physical or sexual intimate partner violence in their lifetime. The Secretary of Internal Affairs, Bradina Drollett, says the survey also revealed that there were limited services available for women who may be in a domestic violence relationship.
The Cook Islands government has a national policy on gender equity and women's empowerment, and one of the key priorities was about eliminating violence against women. And through that sort of study, we knew that there were limited services, and legal services was something that could help shift and change cultural behaviours around domestic violence.
Funding from Australia Aid allowed the Ministry of Internal Affairs to negotiate with the Women's Counselling Centre, Punanga Tauturu, to set up a free legal service. Punanga Tauturu's in-court manager and legal officer, Ngā Tēnā Ngaro, says women who have suffered domestic violence often do not have the means to seek legal advice. She says women need to know there's support in the community and that they can tap into it.
We're aiming to actually reduce violence against women and children. That's the whole aim. Sometimes the mediation and the early intervention actually becomes successful, and learning to compromise about those things and each partner learning their individual rights as well.
Bradina Drollett says apart from financial barriers, some women have a fear and sense of shame of speaking outside of their normal family networks.
The legal services will help women that are facing financial constraints and taking a case through. I'm hoping that it might start shifting those broader social norms to enable women to also overcome some of that, you know, that perceived personal shame, and that might prevent them going to courts as well. And hopefully going to Punanga Tauturu as a counselling service as well will help overcome that.
Wilkie Rasmussen is the first lawyer to have lent his services to the pilot program and had just finished his first day helping out at Punanga Tauturu.
The atmosphere created by the women that runs the scheme is warm. It makes the women that comes forward seeking help feel, I think, included into the process. I found it to be exciting in the sense that these women feels a little bit empowered and they can speak and they can tell us what the problem is.
He says women are advised that everything talked about there is confidential and they're able to bring in family or friends for support when they get advice. Mr. Rasmussen says currently there are 2 hours set aside each week for free legal help, but he says after seeing the demand from the first session, he will be recommending more sessions are made available to women each week.
It's enabling these women to come forward. When I ask them questions, why don't you go and see a lawyer directly, you know, they seem to hesitate with that direct approach. So I think in this way, it gives them a bit of a cushion and therefore makes them encouraged to come forward and say, look, I've got a problem and I need some help.
The pilot program is for 5 weeks, but Punanga Tauturu says it hopes it can work towards making the free legal advice a long-term service. Apart from helping domestic violence victims, it will also provide more general legal services for all types of family law. This is Leilani Momoisea.
Australia has backtracked on its plans to open a foreign mission in Bougainville. Following the announcement last month, the Papua New Guinea Foreign Minister, Rimbing Pato, banned Australians visiting Bougainville, saying there was no consultation. The Australian Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, says she's now holding discussions with PNG about increasing foreign aid staff numbers to Bougainville. Rimbing Pato told Alex Parote that he has lifted the ban, but there are still no foreign missions.
There was
nil consultation, no consultation whatsoever with the Papua New Guinea government before the Australian government announced they will open a foreign mission on the island. And that was why the issue of interference with territorial integrity, our sovereignty, was concerned. So we had to immediately put a tribal ban to get to the bottom of it. And, of course, we've discussed the matter with the Australian Foreign Minister by telephone with myself in the first instance. And then later on, there was a meeting with our Prime Minister, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, and myself in Japan. And then we realized there was a misunderstanding on the part of Australia. And an apology was offered. We've accepted that. And because Australia is one of our very strong bilateral partners, and there's a long-lasting relationship, we've now lifted the ban so that Australians are free to travel in and out of Bougainville and carry on the work that they've been doing.
Before the apology, what was the explanation given to you in that meeting with Julie Bishop? Because either there was communication or there wasn't, and you're saying there was nil, there was no communication at all.
There was no communication. Well, they thought that they had sent some communications to us, but they realized that that was not the case. And so on the basis that they had communicated the matter with us, they'd gone ahead and made the announcement, but realizing that that was not the case, and we were entirely justified in what we did. So in other words, there will be no opening of a foreign mission on the island.
I mean, surely the opening of an embassy would mean that there would be verbal communication between the foreign ministers before that happens.
It should be, but it wasn't. It wasn't. I think that, according to Julie, there were written communications or some form of communications sent to us, but which I'd never seen, and my department never seen it, and the Prime Minister hadn't seen it. So there was some lapse in communication on that basis.
And you're confirming that there will be no Australian embassy opened in Bougainville?
There will be no Australian embassy open in Bougainville. They will continue to carry out their work in the same way they have been doing, and they can run those affairs from the Australian High Commission here in Port Moresby. We will give them the support that we have been continuously providing to the Australian government as an important bilateral partner of this country.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. It's time the opposition leader, Bill Shorten, borrowed from Gough Whitlam's 1972 campaign slogan when he introduced his private member's bill on marriage equality into the federal parliament this week. It's not expected to pass, but marriage equality supporters are hoping that it will add more momentum to building towards another bill with bipartisan support. They want to pressure the Prime Minister to allow coalition MPs to support that when it comes to have it and to have the free vote. Peter Donald reports.
Bill Shorten borrowed from Gough Whitlam's election campaign.
Let us embrace a definition of marriage that respects, values and includes every Australian. Yeah. Let us declare in the House of the Australian people, it is time.
He has a new definition in mind.
Currently, marriage is defined as the union of a man and a woman. Those eight words maintain a fiction that any other relationship is somehow inferior. Our legislation proposes a new definition, the union of two people.
The Labor leader lamented figures that show 2 out of 5 young Australians who are gay have thought about self-harm or suicide.
And we say to all young gay people, we are proud of you for who you are, you belong. We say to you, you have the right to the same hopes, dreams and opportunities as every other Australian, you including the right to marry the person you love.
He says it's time for Australia to join 20 other countries around the world who recognise same-sex marriage.
Let's switch on the light. Let's make 2015 the year when Australians embrace marriage equality. Let's make it happen together. It is time.
Yeah. Is the motion seconded?
It was seconded by Labor's deputy leader Tanya Plibersek, Because of that, this private members' bill will probably never be debated or voted on. The government controls the order of business in the lower house, and for a bill to get up, it's going to need bipartisan support. Christopher Pyne, the government's leader in the lower house, says Bill Shorten has tried to hijack the debate. He spoke to Sky.
Quite clearly, if this is going to go ahead, it needs to go ahead and be owned by the parliament, not by any one political party. And therefore, while we'll deal with Bill Shorten's bill in the normal course of events, there may well be, down the track, other opportunities to debate this issue, ones not controlled or dominated by one political party.
The Greens agree Bill Shorten's bill is going nowhere, but they say it's symbolic and adds to the momentum for change. Along with Labor, they're keeping up the pressure for the Prime Minister to allow coalition MPs a free vote. Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young.
What will Tony Abbott do? Is he going to give his members a free vote or won't he? Will he allow, tomorrow as a gesture of goodwill, to allow coalition members to co-sponsor a bill? If he doesn't, then he will be just the same old Tony Abbott he's always been, standing in the way of marriage equality.
The coalition party room meets tomorrow.
Probably wouldn't miss it for the world this week.
National Senator Matt Canavan. Many Nationals say public sentiment in country areas is still running against same-sex marriage. Matt Canavan says when and if it comes to it, the Nationals should all vote for a traditional definition of marriage.
We are a party that's founded on the protection of traditional values, founded on the protection of the family unit, and I could not believe being a member of a national party which would not have a policy on marriage.
The Prime Minister is in no rush on any of it.
Well, we don't have to do everything immediately. What we need to do right now is get the small business budget boost through the Parliament.
Same-sex marriage campaigners were in the Parliament for Bill Shorten's speech. They've been looking at how the Campaign for Change was run in Ireland and held a press conference with an Anglican reverend and a parent of a gay son, Shelley Argent.
He, as a gay male, cannot marry the person that he loves. And I think, as a parent, that is just so wrong.
Before it was known for housing for one of Australia's most overcrowded asylum seeker detention centres, Christmas Island was famous for its rare red crab population. But the crabs are now under threat from what scientists are calling a catastrophic infestation of yellow crazy ants. Now scientists want to introduce a foreign wasp to try to save the crabs. Lucy Barton has the story.
David Attenborough once described the annual migration of Christmas Island's red crabs as one of the world's great natural wonders. But the crustaceans are under threat from huge swarms of a predator known as the yellow crazy ant. Peter Green is from La Trobe University.
We first noticed what we call super colonies of these ants on the island in 1997. 1,000 ants per square metre on the ground. And when you're in a super colony, it's truly spectacular in a pretty weird and depressing way.
Depressing because crazy ants have killed up to 30 million red crabs on the island since forming super colonies in the 1990s. It's believed the ants first came to the island by ship in the early 20th century. Dr. Green says the invasion is the biggest threat to the biodiversity of Christmas Island.
The crabs walk into a wall of ants, and that alarms the ants, and one of their responses when they're alarmed is to indiscriminately spray this formic acid. You can see the ants spraying acid into the eyes and the mouth parts of the crabs, and I think it corrodes their lungs, and that's how they die.
Christmas Island Shire President Gordon Thompson.
There are all sorts of dreadful consequences, beginning with the environment. The whole ecology of the island would be changed if we didn't have red crabs.
Parks Australia currently controls the ants by dropping baits from a helicopter, but that method also destroys other species. After years of research, Peter Green and his team think they've found a better solution. The crazy ants live off a honeydew secreted by a type of scale insect. Dr. Green says getting rid of the scale is the key to controlling the ants.
If we can introduce a predator of the scale insects that supplies the ants with their food source, that is the honeydew, then we can reduce the amount of food available and indirectly control the ants instead of using poison baits, is what we're doing now. And this is where the micro wasps come. come in.
Parks Australia and La Trobe University are proposing to import a tiny flying insect called the Micro-Malaysian wasp to help kill off the scale. But Australia's previous attempts to wipe out a pest with another species have not always been successful. Perhaps the best-known example is the introduction of the cane toad early last century to protect Queensland sugarcane crops. Today, the toad has become a major pest across northern Australia. Shire President Gordon Thompson.
We see only one problem, and that's the problem the scientific community has to deal with all over the world, and that is when you introduce a new species, does that have unintended consequences like the cane toad?
But Dr. Green says the Malaysian wasp does not pose a risk to humans or other animals.
It's not some big thing that's going to sting people or do anything like that. Tachardia phages somervillii, our micro wasp, is highly specific to that particular family of scale insects.
The proposal to introduce the wasp is being considered by the Federal Agriculture and Environment Departments. If approved, Dr. Green hopes thousands of wasps will be released on the island by the end of the year.
And finally, the Japanese tradition of horseback archery goes back almost 1,000 years. The shoguns used it to keep their samurais ready for battle. But now the ancient sport is undergoing a revival across Japan. Our North Asia correspondent Matthew Carney went to the latest competition and filed this report firsthand.
In the mountains of central Japan lies the ancient capital of Nikko. Huge Japanese cedar trees cover some of the most intricate and impressive shrines in all of Japan. Japan's most famous shogun, or samurai king, Tokugawa Ieyasu, who united Japan for the first time, is entombed at Nikko. Today at his shrine, the samurai spirit lives on. Dressed in samurai outfits, archers on horseback bolt up a track of only 200 metres and try to hit three wooden targets along the way. It requires enormous skill. The riders are taught Zen breathing techniques to steady the mind and body. Only the knees control the horse, and the upper body is kept free and still to draw and shoot the arrows. To master Yabu Same, as the ancient archery is called, was the true mark of a samurai. It demonstrated he'd perfected concentration and discipline and conquered fear. And today at Nikko, the crowds were enthralled by the competition. The riders shout out Inyo Inyo, meaning darkness and light, as they race up the track.
It's incredible. It feels like I'm looking at history in action. It's spectacular.
I'm amazed that they can stop so suddenly after galloping on such a short track.
Only one archer manages to hit all three targets. They use blunt arrows, and when they hit a wooden target, it cracks in half and confetti is released. These days, the archers who perform poorly are not commanded to commit ritualistic suicide like the samurais of old. Hirokazu Omizawa is a champion archer from the famous Ogosawa School of Mounted Archery.
We're doing this to show our skill to the gods.
Omizawa is a 20-year veteran and is sure the rituals of Yabu Same will survive well into the future.
I'm being taught now these 800-year-old skills, and I want to continue on mastering them to be able to pass them down to the next generation.
And Yabu Same is still more ceremony than sport. Riders go through extended blessings from Shinto priests, and it was often performed for the gods to ask for protection and prosperity for land, the people, and the harvest.
And with that story from Matthew Carney, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. We'll see you again very soon. Bye for now.